Hi listener, this is Joe. Just a quick note before we get started on this week's episode. This episode contains some pretty heavy themes that some listeners might find distressing, including animal cruelty, sexual abuse, bullying, suicide, and domestic violence. So if any of these are likely to cause you distress, then best give this one a miss, and we will see you again next week. Otherwise, enjoy the episode.
Oh, just having an insect party
out there. Fucking with each other, yeah.
Are they insects?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, mate. The cicada.
I don't know. There might be some other fucking weird, I was going to say brand.
The cicada, nature's smallest mammal.
Yeah. They could be little mammals. You don't know.
Oh, Jesus. Man, I wish we were doing a bug-related movie now so that this week's intro would tie in perfectly. Nothing to Fear, the podcast for people too afraid of horror movies, but not too afraid of uninformed opinions. I'm your host, David Malloy.
I'm Eliza Sykes.
And I'm Joe Paro.
And we're diving into a brand new thread today, which was my choice after Eliza's three-movie thread, which was the zombie film. We're reviewing the... I've done really well segueing neatly into that.
What is our... Oh, animated horror.
Yeah, that's right. Tasty thread that you've spoiled long before the moment I was going to reveal it.
Just cut me out, you will anyway.
No. It's like, someone has a dissenting opinion. Looks like the razor's coming down. And I wanted to lead into our review film today with not so much a content warning, but more of just a little note that we're going to try and keep this as light and breezy as possible, because both of our movies that we've selected this week are pretty mother-flipping bleak. I think it would be hard to find two equally bleak films again in the history of this podcast. We'll see. But I wanted to lead into it simply by using a quote from Ben Wheatley, because just before we attempted to record this podcast episode the first time, before Joe's laptop shat itself, died, and lost easily the best things we'll ever say on this podcast or in any conversation, recorded or otherwise, I had watched a movie called Kill List by English director Ben Wheatley. And when he was being interviewed about the film, he had this quote, and I thought it was a very good way of kind of summing up our approach to the horror genre in general. And that quote is, "I think that any movie that traumatizes you is a horror film, regardless of how many creatures it has in it." It's also apt because neither movie has any creatures, if you go by the literal definition of the term. So our review film for the week is Darren Aronofsky's latest thriller, Mother.
We spend all our time here. I want to make a paradise.
She redid all of it. Every last detail. And she breathed life back into every room.
Are you happy?
I love you.
Please, come in.
Hello.
Hello. He's a stranger. We're just gonna let him sleep in our house. Hello.
Hello.
Did you know he had a wife? He has pictures of you in his luggage.
What were you doing in their luggage?
What do they want?
God help you.
A young couple living in isolation find their solitude gradually intruded on by unexpected guests. They're all fans of the husband's writing, it seems, but they bring with them unexpected complications that slowly drive the wife to distraction. One of my little bits of preparation for talking about this movie, which has been universally acknowledged as extremely divisive, which I think is great because it's going to make for a more interesting conversation, I hope, is that I listened to the Slash Film Podcast's episode about Mother to get a sense of some other informed critical opinions on what this movie is like. I often find that I'll have like a strong emotional gut reaction to a film, but I like to sort of get a bit of a, you know, what the sense of consensus is from other people generally before I sort of form like a complete defined opinion. And that kind of just sounds like I'm someone who bows to, you know, like whatever popular opinion is, but it's more that I like to see where my opinions and my emotional responses sort of align with the majority of other people's, or if I'm just sort of, you know, throwing out conjecture. But one of the things that really interested me about the Slash Film Podcast episode was one of their reviewers, Jeff Cannata, said that the film made him want to go home and apologize to his wife immediately after, which is just a fascinating response. So before I dive into why I find that interesting, Joe, what are your thoughts on Mother?
I got a lot out of it when I saw it at the movies with you, Dave.
That's
the
correct.
More I'm a bit opposite to you, the more I've engaged with it afterwards from what other people have said and what I've read on the internet, the less I think I like it.
Mm.
Partially that's because I don't think I want to watch it again. I think I got stuff out of it, but I don't have any strong desire to ever go back and watch it again. Partially that's the kind of heavy-handed allegory and all the stuff that I didn't really get into and didn't get anything out of that other people seem to have really focused on. And I won't lie, part of it is reading the cast list and realizing that all of the characters have these pretentious titles, like out of some sort of French existential play, which is like the aesthetes, the whatever.
Well, again, that's just linking to the heavy-handedness of the allegory, right? Like, the credit sequence is just there to hammer home the point that he's making, and it's like, I've so rarely seen, like, I don't think that Aronofsky is necessarily a subtle filmmaker, but I've so rarely seen him, like, take the hammer to his audience saying, this is the point, this is the point.
Yeah, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that in particular, but because it was very far from my experience of the film, it just came across as pretentious as its detractors say that it is.
Yeah, fair enough. Eliza, what was your gut response to this?
I do think it's very funny because you and Joe saw this without me, and the first thing...
Purposefully so.
Oh, how often does that happen? But anyway, we saw it separately, and the first thing you said to me was, Eliza, you're going to hate this film.
Yeah. I don't know, I just got that gut feeling that it just wasn't going to be your jam.
I think I know why. It's because it's so heavily based on a metaphor, and quite often I struggle with that. Not because of metaphors, but just the whole setting up another world, but, you know, and trying to immerse yourself in that world.
Yeah.
But this did it from the start and reiterated it at the end, so that was fine for me.
Okay.
I'm similar to you, Joe. I won't watch it again, probably, which is weird because I really like Aronofsky, but I just feel like I've seen it now and that's it. I didn't dislike it. I quite enjoyed it at the time, but because the metaphor is so over the top and the religious references are so over the top and everything is just like smashing your head against a brick wall, I have no desire to see it again.
Yeah, I get that. I think I will see it again at some point, sort of given enough time to cool off from the first viewing.
Like 10 years?
Maybe 10 years, yeah. Because I had a similar response to Only God Forgives when I first saw it, the film by, what was his name?
Nicholas.
Your mate.
Windings Refn.
Nicholas Winding Refn. Yeah, I had a similar sort of response to that where I kind of walked out thinking, I don't know how I feel, but it's not entirely good, and I probably won't rush to watch it again. But ever since, like, it's burned into the back of my brain, and I'm really, really keen to dive back in and see if, like, a second viewing brings something new to the surface.
Yeah.
I don't know if this film captivated me quite as much as that, but it definitely had me on board, and I think the last third of the movie, which is what for a lot of people kind of turned them off and sort of didn't work for them, I think that was where for me it really kicked into gear and I started to appreciate it on a new level, and it brought back the sense that the thing that I love the most about Aronofsky's approach to directing is him treating it as a sensory experience, and the way that he wants to overload you. And I really like that as a filmmaker, but it's funny. It's so funny that you can simultaneously be a director who is wanting to create that sense of emotional overload, but also being too heavy-handed. So it just sort of becomes silly. It becomes cacophonous instead of being affecting.
Mm.
And it definitely towed that line, I think. But just in my own defense as well, I don't think that you wouldn't have liked this movie because it was dense with metaphor. Like, I don't sort of, you know, it's not like I'm implying that you're not the type to dive into plot analysis and that, or symbology in that sense. It's just more that, like, tonally it struck me as something that would kind of just irritate you. And, well, it's also just, like, it's almost entirely a film about a woman being shat on and just having a bad fucking time. And I can understand why that would be something that you wouldn't necessarily go in for.
Yeah, but at the same time, the way that it's filmed makes it excellent because everything is aligned with this female character. It's such a sympathetic lens.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't make it, it's still horrible, but it's still, it's more bearable in that sense because you are so closely aligned with her and with her feelings and what's going on.
Yeah. It's impossible to not be on her side.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Actually, on that as well, I just remember one of the other points we brought up is that with popular consensus, a lot of people were saying that as far as the casting goes, Joe, that they just couldn't believe Jennifer Lawrence as this kind of doormat character, as this person who would just allow herself to be put in that position. I was like,
wasn't a doormat.
Yeah, like I never saw her as that. I certainly saw her as someone who was, you know, she had a certain willingness to please, but I just put that down to geniality. I didn't put it down to her just being willing to let people walk over her.
No, like, she was just a regular human being and the others were clearly insane. And that was to her detriment.
Yeah.
I feel like, how do you win in film? Because people keep saying, we need more strong female characters. We need more female representation. And then the moment someone does it and does it in a different way, which I think this film genuinely does, purely from the camera techniques and the way that it is filmed and the perspective that it creates, people are up in arms and they just reinforce these stereotypes, which are harming the industry. Like, I don't understand when people will be happy.
When women stop being such... No. yeah, like, it absolutely. And I think it does a disservice to Jael or to imply that she can't be a character who isn't necessarily that quote-unquote strong female lead. I think her vulnerability in this film is exceptional. I think she does such a fantastic job in this role.
Because she's not without agency.
Exactly, yeah. And she's so put upon in this film, and I think that's where a lot of the controversy comes from as well, because the film is essentially just a process of, let's take Jennifer Lawrence by the feet and hammer her against a wall until she's pulp. Mm. And that somehow made her look at Darren Aronofsky and go, this is someone that I want to, you know, like, go to IKEA and look at furniture with. Like, he seems like a stable individual who can be good to me. I think that's part of the controversy around it as well. But going back to the metaphor stuff as well, for me, the reason that it sort of worked was that, yes, it's heavy-handed, and it's definitely heavy-handed on two specific levels, which are the one that Dernunovsky told everyone at the first screening with his stupid pamphlets and stuff that he was handing out, saying that it's a film about climate change. which is, yeah, obvious, but also, like, silly that you feel you need to say that. And Darren, the author is dead. The artist is dead. You need to understand this. You cannot walk out and tell people the meaning of every symbol and metaphor within your film before they've seen the fucking movie. Like, he was defending it before anyone had watched it, and I think that's never a good sign.
No, I disagree with that. I can understand why he would have wanted to do that, absolutely. Because I feel like I haven't seen something like this in a while, and it's very Aronofsky. And even as an example, as soon as the film ended, I heard some people say, I've got to go home and watch some Mother Explainer videos.
Yeah.
Like, the second it ended.
I think that's different, though, because you've had the emotional experience of watching the movie. You've had that first blush, and then you're digging into it. Like, that strikes me as an academic approach. But to come out and say, here is what the movie means, here is what you're supposed to get from this film that I've made you, just prescribes it and locks it into this, you know, strict reading from the artist's perspective that I think weakens the entire film. And I think it shows fear on the part of the artist as well, because it's him coming out and saying, look, you're probably not going to get this, you silly plebs who've never watched a movie before, but I'm an artist and I am making a film about climate change, and it's going to be better than anything Al Gore's ever done. And don't worry, the polar ice caps are going to come back and they're going to say, Darren Aronofsky, you did it. Thank you.
But if he wants the audience to know it's about climate change, why doesn't he just make it clear in the film that it's about climate change?
Because it's an allegory.
I think it's blatant allegory.
I did not get that out of it. I'm not saying it's not there. I'm just saying if he cares enough that he wants the audience to read that into it, why does he have to add this extra performance of leafletting? If he thinks that that should be the main takeaway of the film, why isn't it part of the film?
It is part of the film.
It's very much part of the film, but it's... Yeah.
Why does he feel he has to go and pamphlet then? Do you know what I'm saying?
He's an artist.
No. I think we're all saying the same thing.
If he wants it to be clear in the film, then he wouldn't have to go and pamphlet. And if he's going to pamphlet, then it's like, well, you might not see this because I didn't actually make it clear enough for you, but I really want you to go away with this reading. It's like this weird extra limb on the entire artifice of the film. Audience in the future that will watch the film won't be around to come and pamphlet for them.
Exactly.
Yeah, but Reddit will probably still exist, and he did an AMA, so...
No. Reddit is doomed within the year, I guarantee it. I love the approach of people like David Lynch to being asked about the meanings of their work, because, you know, like, you'll say to David Lynch, oh, there's that scene in Mulholland Drive where there was the guy and there was the creature behind the dumpster, and it didn't seem to link to the rest of the... So why did that happen? And he'll just be like, I saw it in my tea leaf, so I put it in the film. And like, he just never gives a direct answer to anything, because... Excellent. Not because he's being, you know, sort of like intensely deep or saying something that's cryptic. He's just saying bullshit because he's going, I made the film. It's no longer up to me what it means. It's in your hands as the viewer.
I feel like there's this real... I don't know. Aronofsky kind of worries me a little bit, because I feel like he's getting thrust more and more into the public sphere. That's a terrible term to use, but he's becoming more commercial. And I mean, that started with Black Swan, but now I don't know if he feels a tendency to have to explain himself. It is a weird tendency.
Yeah. I feel like you make the film, you should just come out and say, you know, you come out at Cannes when it's screening for the first time and you say, I'm Darren Aronofsky, here's Mother, fuck you, and then screen the movie. Like, it just seems so desperate to be so eager to explain the depth of what you've created.
I wonder if he was really concerned that people would look at Jennifer Lawrence's character as a... not anti... like, just poor treatment of women in a film. And he got so worried about that and the backlash of that, that he felt that he had to explain that the mother character is Mother Nature and not But it didn't need to, because it was set up from the beginning that it wasn't Earth. Like, it wasn't this place. Like, it wasn't the world as we know it.
No. Yeah, it's a clearly stylized thing. I'm not even going to put a spoiler warning on that, because I don't think that is a spoiler. To like, the allegory of her being Mother Earth is so blatant. That...
But you could look at it another way as well, and she's not. You know, there's several interpretations, yeah. I reckon.
But, Joe, did you have anything else you wanted to say in this bit before we jump into spoiler territory?
Nope.
Great.
Now, you're looking for a secret, but you won't find it. Because, of course, you're not really looking. You don't really want to know. You want to be fooled.
So when you hear the sound,
run for cover, motherfucker.
All right, so let's talk about whether or not Mother works. That's kind of the key question.
Oh, that sounds harsh.
Who wants to jump in on this? You motherfuckers. Leaving me high and dry. All right. So as far as... Okay. All right.
I will jump in. Will I? Yes, I will.
Yes, you will.
So works is interesting because I got a lot out of it. So in that sense, it worked for me, but I don't think what I got out of it was intended in any way. Perhaps it was intended that I would be able to make my own meaning. It did work for me, and I can go into it if now is the time, but I think it's an interesting question to ask for this film, because I certainly didn't read any climate change stuff into it. I didn't give a shit about the struggling artist and the inspiration and the messianic figure and any of the scriptural allegory, but I did get a lot out of it. That I had to kind of bring myself.
Like what? If you didn't get... Like, what do you mean?
What could you get from this?
I'll tell you. So the two most affecting things of the film for me were... And they were both to do with Jennifer Lawrence's journey. One, the idea that no matter how much you love something, that... And this might be a bit dark, but... That's not a guarantee of getting that back. Mm. And for me, that's a deeply troubling concept. And that I got that quite strongly from the film. But the other thing, which is a bit easier to explain, is that she had put so much of herself into building something. And I feel like I'm at a point in my life where I've done a similar thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where I've put years into... certain things, my uni degree, my relationship, in an effort to build a future that I want to live out. And watching Jennifer Lawrence's future that she wants to live out and that she's put so much work and love into just be pulled away from her so painfully really hit home for me and made me think about that as a terrifying possibility in my life. Mm. So obviously Mr. Aronofsky couldn't have meant that in the film to tell those particular stories to me, because it's all about my situation.
I don't know. I think he did. I think that's definitely there. There
was maybe in a broader way,
where,
but he couldn't
there was
have...
the bit where J-Law turned to the screen and was like, what if this was you, Joe? And I pondered over that for a little while. But...
See, I was going to argue with you, but then I realized you were just being funny.
Goofing.
That's so right. Funny.
Yeah, so it did work for me, and that's what I got from it. And I came out of the cinema going, well, that film made me think about things that are very interesting and important to me. Mm. Yeah.
That's good. That's a good thought process. It's a good insight into the mind of Joe. Oh,
I love that even as a film critic, you still sound like my 78-year-old grandfather going, now that film made me think about things. made me laugh, you know?
Even in a rave singlet, he manages to be a 78-year-old man.
I'm playing, 78-year-old men can rave. They can
wear the paint. What about a 78-year-old man mowing the lawn?
Yeah, that's it. That's it. He wouldn't listen to a podcast. He wouldn't know how to download it.
He'd listen to As My Father Does, even though he's not 78, but he has a pair of headphones that has an FM radio built into it.
Oh my God. That's magic.
An FM radio? AM all the way. AM is the only band.
It might be both. The point is, it's a radio built into headphones. That would be your deal though, wouldn't it?
Talk back,
I haven't
Joe,
listened to FM radio for about a decade.
No, they're just like... They're not talking enough. They're just playing all of these weird trash tunes that I don't understand. All of this trap music.
Oh.
I think I felt similarly when it came to a direct emotional response to the film, because the reason that Jeff Cannata was talking about wanting to apologize to his wife was for slightly different reasons to me. His whole reasoning was essentially that he is a public figure as as a member of the Slash Film cast, but also with the other work that he does. His job is about being in the public eye and his opinions being in the public eye. And his wife is very much the opposite. She's not a figure in the public eye. The work that she does is in the private sector. So she has no reason or desire to be known by the broad public. And so there's an interplay there between the situations that he puts her in simply by nature of her being his partner. And he felt the need to sort of bring that knowledge back into his relationship and the certain discomforts that she felt as a way of working to make her feel more comfortable and to make her environment, or the environment that they build together as a couple, stronger. And that I empathize with a great deal, because I struggled to talk about this a little bit, because there is a point where you're sort of saying, I saw Mother and it made me want to reassess my relationship, because I saw some things there that were familiar. People would just be like, what the fuck? And they'd be calling Pam and being like, get out of the house, you need to leave right now, things are very bad. But it's nowhere near on the level of this film. I would simply say that it's to do with the relationship between an introvert and an extrovert. And there's much more to the film than that, and I would not for a second imply that Javier Bardem's character is not in some way abusive, but the nature of his work puts him in the public eye, and his partner simply wants to be left alone with the home that they've built together and share in that space. My partner is very much an introvert. She needs recharge time. She needs the weekends to garden and to do things that don't involve other people so that she can rekindle her energy, essentially, rekindle her fire. I, on the other hand, desperately, desperately need other people. I draw my energy from others like a well. And that creates an interesting dynamic in a relationship, because for me, it's all about not overdrawing from her while still getting the energy that I need. And for her, it is allowing herself to be the source of energy for me, and to acknowledge the fact that in being in a relationship with me, that I'm going to have that desire to be around her and other people and that need for human contact, whereas she's always going to need that time to recharge. And how does she get that escape? And I've had parties at our house where people have come around and they've been around for X number of hours and the house is left in a certain state and all that sort of thing, you know, as parties go. And I know the exact point that she reaches where it's simply too much, because her private space, her escape, is now filled with these people. And it doesn't matter how lovely those people are and how much they mean to her and how important they are to me, eventually there will just reach a point where the well is empty and there's nothing left to draw on. And any further infringement on that becomes almost physically painful. Because my brain is stupid, it took me watching this movie to understand that experience. It's not as simple as having a friend or a partner or something like that tell me how they feel. I have to be put into that mind space in order to have an ability to empathize with it. And that is what I owe Darren Aronofsky for this film. Mm. I think it's improved my relationship.
Yeah, right. See, I think I look at it in a different way, which is probably similar, but I mean, I've been thinking a lot lately about, and read a few articles about, the need for women to make sure that they're not upsetting men.
Mm.
In
well,
terms
really?
Of the tendency what? To not tell men that something is happening in order... You know what I mean? You don't know what I mean.
I know what you mean. I'm bothered by it. As in people saying... that women should do this or that that's an expectation?
No, it's an expectation.
Okay, all
it's
right.
It's just an ingrained thing, and it does exist, and it is a thing.
Emotional labor, right? Like yeah. That's, yeah.
Yeah, and so I thought of it more that way, but...
Yeah, totally. Oh, it absolutely has that as yeah. well. Very, very much so. Mm. I think both of them are super, super present in the film. Yeah, so that for me was really, really strong. It made me not want to apologize because I'm not an abusive partner, but it made me want to better understand and better accommodate the person that I care about in my life and, you know, to improve the quality of our time spent together. So that as Joe, you were saying, that thing that we've built has a stronger foundation and isn't just built on my passion as separate to her happiness. That's where the whole artist and muse layer of the allegory falls apart for me, is that the moment that it becomes about the artist and the muse and the artist essentially using these people for inspiration and then discarding them, like, I feel it impossible to sympathize with that. I find there's nothing in Javier Bardem's character, particularly towards the end of the film, when he just becomes blatantly domineering, that I could sympathize or empathize with. He becomes quite a painted villain at that point. And before that, when he was refusing to listen to his partner, he was simply just a shitty husband. I didn't look at him as the great artist who had to make sacrifices. I looked at him as a leech.
I think that as well, but then at the same time, I still have this tendency to be sympathetic with him a little bit. It's like his work becomes so important to him that he's swept up with the emotions of it, and the frenzy and the chaos and everything just becomes, it just consumes his entire character. Mm. And also the fact that J-Law or the mother character seems to be regenerated at the end into something else. It's like he's constantly trying to find a balance between having this muse and having this person that supports him and also fostering his own creativity.
Yeah.
So I'm a little bit less angry about him as a character than you seem to be,
but
I think.
Not, he's not finding that muse and he's not finding
that
balance.
He's constantly trying to get that balance right again and again and again, and he can't.
He's burning through them. Yeah. Like, his search for this balance is destroying other people.
Yeah.
Like, that in my mind makes him quite clearly the villain.
Yeah.
I struggle to see him as anything else. I also just, I don't know, Joe, it sounds like you were sort of thinking along the same sort of lines. As soon as any artist makes an artwork that is about the process of making the artwork, like, unless that meta commentary is embedded in the work itself, when it's sort of blatant and on the surface, then I just immediately pull away. I immediately cringe from that.
Yeah, me too. And I don't know if that says more about me or about the work. From memory, I think Stardust Memories by Woody Allen did it okay, but that was in a period of my life where
the child rapist.
Woody Allen.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I can ever go there again.
Probably not.
Not on this podcast,
but I think,
certainly.
Yeah, not in public. I think, to me, Dave, what you and I both got from it speaks to the fact that the most powerful part of the film was Mother's journey.
Yeah.
Because that you saw a bit of your partner's journey in that, and I saw a bit of my own journey. And him... How do you say it? Javier Bardem?
Javier.
He's...
Oh, God. I'm so angry now.
I think it's more Javier Bardem.
Yeah.
Javier.
Yeah.
Sure. Javier Bardem. His journey was not so interesting to me at all.
Yeah.
He served as a point for Mother's journey, and so once it stopped becoming about seeing those amazing close-up shots of Jennifer Lawrence in full claustrophobia, then it was not as interesting.
Oh, see, yeah, like, sorry, I think I misread what you just said. Can you say that again? Sorry, just for me.
No, probably for everyone. So when the moments in the film where it was not as much about Mother's character, it was more about Javier Bardem's character, were not as interesting to me. The best
yeah.
moments of the film for me, this is, yeah, it's good that I said it again because this is a much more eloquent way of saying it. The best moments of the film were the close-up shots of Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah.
Because those were the moments of the film where her journey was the strongest and the claustrophobia and the empathy was at its greatest.
Yeah.
The moments where it focused on Javier and his whatever creative bullshit he was going through were not so interesting to me.
Yeah, and I think they were saying as well, like, in things that I've read, that that was, like 90% of the shots in the film were that sort of over-the-shoulder thing of Jennifer. So it's, yeah, like you said, the presence of, you know, the female story is very clearly the most important thing about it. And, yeah, that's a lot to take away from it. I think that's pretty good. Mm. I think the only other two things to point out, because we have labored on this, the only other two things to point out, so we've got the relationship of introvert to extrovert. We've got the relationship of man to woman, which I think is, I guess, is just sort of inherently part and parcel to the film. You've got the relationship of mankind to the earth, which is this thing that Aronofsky wants to put forward. And especially considering, you know, she puts her ear to the house, the walls and everything, and you can hear the heart beating and all that sort of things.
She feels the pain that the house goes through.
Yeah, 100%. And that all of the unfoldings of the third act are very much sort of what can mankind do to destroy this place. And it's not simply pulling apart the house. It's war, it's torture, it's executions.
Even taking away her child.
Taking away her child, which is a super, super clear Christ allegory.
Oh, there's so many.
Yeah, and so and the religious layer is definitely like
Cain and Abel, man and yeah, woman, well, Adam and Eve. Fucking stop now.
Which is, I didn't pick this up before. I do like the intricacy of that. Like the reason that Woody Harrelson's character was walking around with his hand on his ribs and saying like, "Don't worry about it, I just have a pain." Of course, like he's woman. that Adam figure. And then Michelle Pfeiffer, who's fucking fantastic in
yeah,
this movie,
is
that sort of, you know, kind of snake-like character, this original conception of woman as someone deceitful.
Yeah.
So as that, I sort of picture her more as Lilith than I do Eve, but, you know, whatever. The religious allegory is there, is the point. You've got Cain and Abel. That layer being so clear and so dense kind of means that the moment it's transparent, it sort of loses its power.
Mm.
Like, with something like... Nerd reference alert! With something like Neon Genesis Evangelion, where that religious allegory is present and even omnipresent, but it's never explained, that gives it some power. At the end of the day, I think Mother is a worthwhile experience going to. I think as a purely sensational cinematic experience, watch it in a place that you have decent sound and at a time when you are prepared for the onslaught that you are about to experience. And I will give it, on further consideration, 3.5 delicious babies out of 5. Don't laugh quietly, Joe. The audience can't hear how much you appreciate my funny joke.
But you know that I always appreciate all of your funny jokes.
Aww.
I will give it... I'll give it 3... destroyed kitchen... What's that thing?
It's the sink, yeah.
Unbraced sink.
It wasn't the sink. Unbraced sink. Ready? I will give it 3 unbraced sinks out of 5.
Nice. Good nice. One. Glad you got that on the first time.
You ruined the illusion.
So
you ruined
cool.
the illusion.
Eliza.
I think that this film is worth it. You should go and see it purely for the technique alone.
Mm.
I think the technique is so strong, and that's always what draws me to an Aronofsky film, because it's just going to feed my desire for something fucked up, but also look very nice at the same time.
So pretty.
So I'm going to give it 3.5 annoying unwanted guests out of 5.
I love the half guest. I want to see that.
Yeah.
Thing. Is that the baby?
Just someone very short.
All right, thank you very much for your contribution, Dernernerski. Look up the name. It's spelled exactly as it sounds.
Nah, you want to say it more bogan, like Darren Aronofsky.
Darren Aronofsky? Oh yeah, my mate Darren Aronofsky. Yes, chucked a film together, eh? Moving on to our new thread. So this is one that I have kind of set us as a challenge. The reason I say challenge is mostly because we've been able to name two films that fit this category and not a third. We don't know what the last film is going to be yet, but our new thread is animated horror, and our first film is King of Pigs.
Jong-so-ga. 오랜만이다. 갑자기 만나자고 한 이유가 뭐냐?
철이 얘기를 하고 싶어서 만나자고 했다.
누구부터 죽여줘!
철이 얘기 한바탕 하니까 시원하냐?
아니, 아직 철이 얘기 하지도 않았어. 지금부터가 내가 하고 싶었던 얘기야.
Guess who didn't write a synopsis yet again?
Can that just be your synopsis?
I've just got to get there. Names.
There's a two-sentence synopsis on IMDb.
Well, that's where he's going.
It's the King of Pigs as well, so I'll just say that in my big dramatic voice. The King of Pigs.
That was very dramatic.
So big. All right, so dramatic.
This is a terrible synopsis.
All right.
Just read the synopsis.
Wait. No.
Read this one first for Joe, so then, but do it how you would normally.
I'm just going to do my voice though. The King of Pigs. Better?
Beautiful.
It's like my Vati video voice. All right, this is the one on IMDb, Joe. Jong-suk and Kyung-min meet up to talk about their high school past. It's been 15 years since they last talked. It brings up all kinds of memories.
That is a terrible synopsis.
Those are all the pertinent details. What more do you need?
But that last sentence, it brings up all kinds of memories. Like, it just got
does,
so...
Does yeah, it or does yeah, it not,
cue
Eliza?
The,
so
cue the,
lazy.
Cue the song from Journey.
Which one?
You know, the one that's in the break. Don't stop. Believe. What's the one in the Breakfast Club?
Not that one.
Don't you.
Yeah, it's not Journey.
Forget about me. I haven't seen the Breakfast Club.
That is a film. That is a beautiful film.
Why haven't you seen it? You should definitely.
It has not been screened in a room that I've been in before.
Come over, you fuckwit.
I do want to watch the Breakfast Club. It's one of those ones as well that I've put it off for so long that I now just don't want to.
Nah, it's actually really good. I didn't want to watch it for ages because I thought it was overhyped. And then I watched it and was like, why did I wait so long?
Which was me and Ferris Bueller's Day Off as well.
Yeah.
Which was dope.
Yeah.
So much fun.
Anyway, we should talk about
Horror movies. Because all of our listeners will have already watched The Breakfast Club and Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Like, those are not traumatizing experiences. Those are delightful romps.
Well, depends how you look at it.
That's
you can
true.
Find misery in anything, really.
I mean, I guess with Ferris Bueller's Day Off particularly, if you're not Ferris...
Oh, funny because it's true, Eliza.
So true.
At the beginning of The King of Pigs, Jong-suk, a hardworking salaryman, has just killed his wife. On the back of this event, he gets in touch with old schoolmate Kyung-min to meet up and talk about their old school experiences. And specifically, a young man named Chul, who holds the key to their shared past.
That was beautiful.
That's because I'm a fucking writer.
I like that positivity.
So King of Pigs is a laugh-a-minute, feel-good summer romp from South Korea by director Sang-ho Yeon, who also directed a movie called The Fake, which has been highly recommended to Eliza in the past, I think.
Yep.
It's not one that I've seen. This is my first experience of Sang-ho Yeon's films, but it's definitely not my first experience of Korean filmmaking in general. And I found that a lot of Korean filmmaking tends to have the through line of utter nihilism. Like, there's just no hope in so many Korean films. The only exception that I can think of to mind is The Host. That's the only one. And even his other films are pretty fucking lacking in hope. That's Bong Joon-ho, who is a fucking incredible Korean filmmaker, and you should watch all of his movies right now.
Dave, did you say this was the first Sung-ho Yeon film that you'd watched?
Yes.
Train to Busan.
You're fucking kidding me.
No, is it?
He directed that.
Did My he? Dude.
Did he actually?
Yeah.
My dude.
Yeah, he did.
My dude, Sung-ho
Yeon.
According
to the internet.
According to the internet.
Okay, we're consulting. Mother
of my God.
Mother of God. Okay, all right. Okay.
How did we not know that? We did Train to Busan.
Okay, David from 10 minutes ago put him straight in the bin.
Like, literally last, the one before this episode.
Granted, that was like 3 months ago.
Don't say that.
Yeah.
It pretty much was.
Dispelling the illusion here. Oh,
I've
my
already ruined
God,
it.
Of course. Yeah, okay, so... As far as his real world filmmaking goes, he's a fucking treasure.
This one looks really good.
I absolutely adore Train to Busan, as you well know, listener. But I've not experienced his other animated work, which is called The Fake. King of Pigs is quite a down-to-earth drama, as it looks like most of his animated work is. It has that sense of just being... about interrelationships between normal people in normal environments, and King of Pigs is very much focused on that. Where it takes its flights of fancy and uses its animated form is specifically to do with hallucinations and, yeah, like emotional responses to stimuli, which I think is where the film really shines. And a lot of the time I think I wanted more of that from this movie. I wanted much more of those flights of fancy, specifically because it is so goddamn relentlessly brutal and bleak and miserable. So I think, the big question is, why would you watch this, Joe?
I mean, what resonated the most was just how... horribly ugly it was, like in all senses of the word. Mm. Sorry, no, I shouldn't say in all senses of the word. It was very beautiful in its own way.
But it is ugly. It's
but it's so ugly.
Yeah.
And so what is the virtue of making a film that is that bleak and ugly with no redemption at all?
That is the question.
That I pose to you.
I just think in terms of the violence, I feel like I haven't seen anything that violent in a while. It felt so real. So real. It wasn't stylized at all. And the way that the frame would shake when someone was angry and you could feel it. And even though the sound was a bit dodgy at times, it still
so
added
good.
To it.
It worked so well.
Yeah,
though.
It felt so natural.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The voiceover recording
was
garbage, hey?
Yeah,
like,
it was
you're just
funny.
Constantly peeking. And I
was
just had
just
to
astonished.
Sort of constantly Sorry, remind man. Myself that this is like, you know, just let's assume for a moment that this is probably a pretty low budget film in a country that, you know, maybe the filmmaker doesn't have access to the absolute best in sound equipment. So I had to sort of check myself a little bit, but it did great constantly hearing that.
Yeah.
I thought if it was made as a stylistic choice, it would be justified, though.
Yeah.
I thought that it fit very well. And I was constantly amazed at how effective the film was for an animated film.
Yeah.
Like the
Whoa.
Like you're saying, Eliza, the... Sorry?
Whoa there. It's slighting the form of animated
no,
film.
No, it's not slighting no. it. It's just that it was able to... And I feel this too. I feel like I haven't seen... anything, at least for a long time, that's been animated that had the same effect that this did. It didn't feel like an animated movie. It felt like live action. It hit all the right points in making me just feel so affected by it, which I did not expect.
I'm so excited for you guys to watch the next movie now. I'm so excited for it because I've handpicked it for this exact reason.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I don't even know what it is.
Watch this space.
But not only was it an animated film, but it was clearly done on a small budget. Mm. There were a lot of static shots. And I think for a film to be clearly a small budget animated film and still for it to be so effective, in particular in the violence, it just felt you know, very real and horrible.
Mm.
It's extremely impressive.
Yeah, it's. I think we're all agreed that it's definitely an impressive achievement. Now, I guess is the question is like, is this one that is going to be a valuable experience for most cinema going people?
Probably not.
You reckon?
Probably not. I would say.
Here to like to speak to Chul's sort of main approach to set the scene essentially in talking about their school lives. These two main characters, Jong-suk and Kyung-min, are just relentlessly bullied. They're one of them. Jong-suk is from a poor family. Kyung-min is from a wealthier family, but they're nowhere close to the level of wealth that defines the upper echelons of the class. And the richer kids in the class are part of a caste system that just relentlessly reinforces itself through cruelty. So those kids are subordinate to kids from higher age brackets who are also very wealthy and very influential and who have a particular say in what the atmosphere and behaviors of people, the atmosphere of this school and the behavior of people who attend it should be. And they beat on people who don't fit those exact definitions, and they call their victims bullies. They imply that the people who are being victimized are somehow trying to ruin the school spirit, and they place the onus of responsibility on the victims, which is a constant theme throughout the film. And Chul's entire approach is that to overcome evil, you need to become more evil than your enemies, which is already a pretty harrowing philosophy to, you know, rest this movie on the back of. And it certainly doesn't get much lighter from there. I think the performances are of a very, very high standard, and I think the writing is often pretty standout. But the nihilism of the film, just the relentlessness of the nihilism, I think actually dragged it down in my eyes a little bit. I needed some moments of levity from the animal killing and the constant beating and, you know, sexual abuse. And I've watched films that featured similar levels of persistent acts of cruelty, like Martyrs is a good example, and I didn't find Martyrs as relentless as this film.
The thing is, though, this film still had moments of conscience.
Yeah.
It absolutely did. There were moments, it wasn't like it was just glorified or what's the word that
but
I'm looking for?
But those moments of conscience
what's
often...
the word that I'm looking for? The word that is gratuitous.
Yeah.
It wasn't gratuitous. I think it was very important to the characters and the way that they developed.
Yeah, I think so too, but at the same time, that's all painted by the fact that so many of those moments of conscience came through from Jong-suk, who we know from the first frame of the film has suffocated his wife just out of frustration.
Mm.
And that paints every, you know, observation of morality throughout the rest of the film as tainted.
Mm.
That's something I really struggled with, and certainly, if, you know, as the intention of the filmmaker, that's effective. I just didn't know if it's something that I got a lot out of as a viewing, as an audience member.
Mm. I think it's interesting now realizing that it's the same person that did Train to Busan.
Mm.
There's a lot of similar themes going on there, and definitely the whole social class struggle is something that's very evident, and I'm so excited to go watch all of his films.
I'm so excited to go rewatch Train to Busan because fuck me, Dad, that movie
that
is
was a
so
great
good.
Movie.
Holy shit. And should we be at all surprised that someone who has a basis in working in animated film knows how the fuck to frame a live action movie?
Yeah,
like,
that's true.
His action sequences, like you said, they're so effective in this film, and that translates so beautifully in Train to Busan.
When I was watching King of Pigs, I thought that it seemed like a live action movie. Like, the way that it was framed was so
it's got
live
that,
action. It wasn't anime to me.
What's the word? It's got that sense of gravity, but that same sense of momentum.
Yeah,
yeah.
Movement.
And so when the hits hit, it you feel like you can feel it.
Yeah.
Oof. God.
Joseph Parrow, say your thoughts.
I'm just waiting for the plane to go away.
Oh, holding for the plane.
It's probably not as loud. Oh, actually, hang on. Skype is going through the mic. It is that loud. Carry on.
It's super loud. Dave, I am glad that it didn't compromise on its bleakness.
Okay.
I am glad that it didn't have... I feel like it's a standout film because of that. And if it had lightened it with moments of levity, then it just wouldn't be as special and unique a film as it is. I don't know about the virtue of having a completely bleak film. But again, for me, this is why I liked Tetsuo the Iron Man, because it's a new experience. And anytime a film gives me an experience that is genuinely novel to me, I like that film and I like that experience.
But is it novel to be so...
It is. But to have a film that feels like that, it felt very unique. And I think its bleakness was a part of that.
Yeah.
And the lo-fi... Look, I compare it to Black Metal in a lot of ways. It's very lo-fi.
Joe's other frame of reference.
Yeah.
It's uncompromisingly bleak. And it's all about creating this kind of unique feeling. And you know that the thing I get most out of films is films that feel cool.
Mm.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I guess that's what I got out of it.
I appreciate that as a response. I guess... Yeah, I don't necessarily feel that I haven't seen movies that are similarly grey and lifeless and cruel. And I say those as, you know, intentionally as descriptive words as opposed to judgmental words. I've definitely seen films that are on a similar plane. It's a film that sees humanity's defining characteristic as evil. And maybe I struggle with this because that's diametrically opposed to the way that I perceive mankind. I just don't see life being like that. That comes from a place of privilege, I will be the first to admit. And I do not believe... You know, I'm not saying that I believe that people are incapable of cruelty, but I do like to believe that, you know, the moral compass of the universe swings towards the good. And that, essentially, while humans are capable of cruelty, the strata of a dog-eat-dog society is not inherent to being human. It is inherent to an existing social order that is capable of being changed. So I think to resign yourself to a mentality that is this uncompromising and this incapable of systemic change is, I think, yeah, honestly, detrimental to the world. I definitely think painting a picture of this particular mindset and the suffering that these characters go through is very valuable, inherently valuable. But I think the mindset, the deeply, deeply nihilistic mindset that implies that the world or people essentially cannot possibly change beyond this vicious animalistic existence that they have, I just don't see that as necessarily being a story that brings me to a sense of narrative catharsis.
That's very optimistic of you.
It is, yeah. I'll be the first to admit that. I mean, I am an optimist. I'm extremely idealistic. I see cruelty in the world. You know, I haven't lived a life that's been free of these things, but much as I have lived, you know, a life of privilege comparatively to many people in the world, that doesn't mean that I think it's inherent to all people. Whereas this film, no one escapes. No one is innocent. No one is capable of salvation.
I'm not sure that the film wants to say that that's what being human is about.
Yeah, I agree.
I think it is much more about circumstance. Yeah. So the only reason that the main character kills his wife is because it's a legacy of this trauma that he suffered growing up.
Mm.
It doesn't say anywhere that this is what people are inevitably. It just says that this is what circumstance does to people.
Yeah, and...
Sorry, Eliza.
Sorry, I cut you off.
No, go for it.
Oh, thank you, Joe. I was just going to say, and specifically, it's an an exaggeration of how flawed the social system or the standing or the class system is. You know?
Yeah.
Because and purely because Train to Busan has the same themes. Like, it's just, I think it's more specific than mankind being bleak and nihilistic.
Yeah, I just didn't get the same sense of hopelessness out of Train to Busan.
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a greater deal of redemption.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that definitely sort of paints the picture of Train to Busan being more of a hero's journey, essentially. Like, there was a great act of sacrifice, and it's all about you becoming selfless and all that sort of stuff. Whereas I understand that The King of Pigs is not necessarily about that. I just didn't walk away with it with any greater lessons about the world than sometimes life is shit and that the class system, the existing class system, benefits no one. I didn't really walk away with any greater understanding of the world, I think, from that.
Yeah, I understand that. I think the one moment of redemption in the film is that... Who's the monster kid?
As in the one who, like, goes nuts and beats people up and knifes them and shit?
Yeah.
Chul.
Cool. I guess, are we in spoiler territory?
No, it's Chul. Got you.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd say we are.
Can I talk about the ending?
Yeah, yeah, let's dive on into spoiler territory. Let's drop that sting.
Run for cover, motherfucker!
The one moment of redemption in the film is when he decides not to throw himself off the roof because he thinks it's stupid.
Mm.
Yeah.
Which happens after he runs into his mum. And that's the point where the film changes from this strange fantasy world where it was getting dangerously close to romanticizing suicide to him having a kind of awakening and realizing what real life was about.
Yeah. And he wasn't the only person to romanticize suicide in the film either. Like, pretty much everyone felt that their only way out of this situation they found themselves in was public suicide. Like, there were at least three different characters who were always saying, I should just kill myself in front of a crowd and show those fuckers. And that was the only agency they felt they had.
I know. That kind of did raise my hackles because I thought it's worth talking about these things and I understand where it fits into the film. But when you skirt dangerously close to a romantic mindset of suicide, then you're not doing anyone any favours.
Yeah, it's funny because maybe I'm just being mercurial today, but it's like I disagree with you guys on the other point that you don't think the film is that sort of necessarily nihilistic, but I don't think that the film romanticized suicide in any sense. I felt like just everyone was in such a dog shit situation that they all felt that was the only agency they had, the only power that they had to exert in the world was whether or not they lived or died.
I think that romanticizes suicide though.
Okay, fair enough.
That it makes a statement, that your death can make a statement. Yeah,
but that also just for me paints the image that you guys were talking about before of the class system putting people in this valueless position. I don't know if it necessarily made suicide seem like something powerful or glamorous or, you know, worthy of considering.
I feel like this is another one of those situations where we're all saying the same thing in different ways.
The nothing to fear way.
Let's argue until we die.
I would love that. I do want to argue with you guys until I die.
Aww.
It's funny that it sort of comes back to this animal thing that the rich kids are the pigs and the rich kids are the pigs and the other kids are the dogs.
No, the poor kids are the pigs, the rich kids are the dogs.
Yes, the poor kids are the pigs. That's right, because they think that their only way to become happy is to become fat, and that is to fall prey to the ideology of capitalism, which again sounds like something that you're regularly harping on about, Joe.
It's true, I am. But I think you've done all the harping that can be done.
Well, I think, to be fair, Sang Ho Yeon has done all the harping that needs to be done.
And there was a lot of stuff about masculinity in there as well.
Yeah, yeah. And there's an element of toxic masculinity in this film, which is undeniable. One of the interesting things there is the fact that domestic violence in this film is not inherently linked to class. Yeah, so, like, Jong-suk kills his wife at the beginning, and he's the poor guy, so you could assume that that's very much the comment that the film is making. But then almost immediately after, you see that Kyung-min also beats the shit out of his partner out of similar frustrations. And so it's not necessarily linked to class strata. That's just something that manifests across this society because masculinity is not dealt with in a healthy manner. Like, it's not something that's spoken about in any way that speaks to its more problematic elements.
Mm. I did worry early on that the film was just going to be about making us feel sympathy for these domestic abusers.
Yeah.
But I think that it managed to transcend that.
Yeah. I'll agree with you
even
on that.
Even though all the female characters were murdered, or the girlfriend who, even though she was beaten, was still very subservient, and the wife who was a sex worker.
But again, that's not unusual for Korean film. Like, I look back to I Saw the Devil, and every single female character that is sexually abused without agency, either murdered or in some way put upon by the men in their environment. Like, women in this particular social environment are, it's hard to even say valued as secondary. They're treated as cattle, which again, I guess, feeds into the animal metaphors that this film often brings in. I guess I appreciate the fact that these Korean filmmakers are quite, you know, they see it as important bringing violence against women to the fore, but at the same time, I'm not seeing as many films by female Korean filmmakers or films that have women in the lead roles that push those points forward. I'm just seeing more stories about men hurting women and feeling bad about it. And I don't want to sort of act as if I'm just being, like, you know, pretending to some sort of, like, high and mighty pedestal here. Like, oh, we're so woke over here. You know, Korea, get your shit together. It's
you
just
are the one
that
keeps using the word woke.
I know, yeah. But I'm using it with an ingrained sense of self-loathing. So
that's fine, then. As long as you're self-loathing.
As long as you don't like yourself. The best moments all came with the animal referencing. And I guess it's for the best that they were kept to a minimum instead of pushed forward all of the time. But I loved the moment where the dog snapped at Kyung-min in the street and he turned around and the dog looked back at him over his shoulder and was smiling. I loved the ghost cat tormenting Jong-suk, tormenting Chul throughout the rest of the film.
Mm.
I adored those images. I thought they were the strongest moments of the film.
Hmm.
I really like the ending.
Okay.
I remember you said something before, Eliza, about how you didn't like the ending.
I just didn't understand it. It just ended so abruptly, and I was like, what?
It did end abruptly.
What? Why is it ending here?
Oh, and that's right, because we talked about the specific pullout of the camera, right?
Yeah, just there was a dramatic zoom. It was a crash zoom, if you will.
Yeah, it's something I'm, I guess, quite used to from watching anime, that sort of idea of leaning into moments of drama and really going all out with them.
Yeah, but it was just so strange because there weren't that many other points in the movie that did that. There's something that felt so realistic, and then at the end it's like, woo, here's the moon and something poetic. Like, it was a bit jarring.
Yeah, but you said the same thing, if I remember, about the moments of soft piano music in Train to Busan, right?
I didn't say that. Joe did.
But that's that same sort of idea, right? Like, those are, you know, cultural tropes, they exist within Asian cinema. So I guess we're not so used to them as a Western audience, but that's totally par for the course in any Japanese, Korean,
I have seen
Chinese
a fair bit
well.
Of Japanese and Korean film, and I know they are tropes. I'm just saying in this film in particular, that because the style, because it was not stylized violence, because it felt so real, not, I don't want to say real because animation was still real, but because it felt so much like a non-animated film, it was just jarring at the end to have that one thing that just seemed so out of place. But yeah, you know, that's
fair enough.
Fine.
I thought it tied it all together quite well in a neat little package.
Maybe that's why I didn't like it.
Sorry if that sounded sarcastic. I definitely get the impression in the room that we thought pretty highly of King of Pigs, but it seems like I probably had the least reaction to it, so I'm going to leave my own impression to last. So, Eliza, what did you think of King of Pigs?
Yeah, it was good.
So traditionally on this podcast, we give a star rating. So let's maybe go back to the old model for a second.
Oh, I forgot. I guess I'll give it 3 startling crash zooms out of 5.
It's so hard not to pick a metric that's just really depressing and inappropriate.
Do it.
For this film.
Do it.
I'll give it 3.5.
Great. This is going to be a 2-hour cut now, Joe. Thanks.
Belt whips to the face out of 5.
Oh, that's beautiful.
I loved the belt whip to the
so
face
bleak.
As well. That was one of my favourite fight sequences. I love Chul. I really love the way that he just sort of got amongst it. For me, I'm going to give King of Pigs gets 3 ghost cats out of 5.
Nice one.
Thanks again for tuning in, listeners. That is the end of this week's podcast. Next week, we'll be doing our second animated film, which is Satoshi Kon's psychological thriller, Perfect Blue. I am so hyped for this film. And something else, TBC. You'll see.
TBC.
Get your suspense feelers ready.
Is it meant to be TBD? I think
shockwaves
TBC
of
before.
Tension we're sending out over the next week of your life.
Oh. So it is TBC.
Until then, you can get in touch with us on Twitter if you send us a message at nothing2fearpod, that is the number 2, or use the hashtag nothing2fear.
I guess you could like Google us and find us on Facebook.
That's a possibility. Or you could go to facebook.com/nothing2fearpod.
I don't do that. I don't search through Facebook. I just Google everything.
You could also send us an email at nothingtofearpod@gmail.com.
Once again, that is the number 2. Don't forget the number 2. Do get in touch with us if there's any horrific experiences you don't want to have, but that you want us to have vicariously for you. Please let us know. We'll go ahead and do those.
To clarify, in a film. In not...
a... I don't know. Like, it depends on the experience, but... Look, you know, the form of this podcast could change if you have a phenomenal suggestion, but it depends on what I have to put in my mouth. So we'll see. We'll wait until the emails come in, essentially.
Okay.
That's when we'll judge it.
Right.
But until that time, I'm David Malloy.
I'm Eliza Sykes.
I'm Joe Parrow.
Why was it a question?
I don't know. I forgot.
Until that time, I'm David Malloy.
I'm Eliza Sykes.
I'm Joe Parrow.
I said it with more conviction.
And until next time, stay hopeless.
I don't like androids.
Blade Runner 2019.
Is it that time again for Eliza to assert her opinion very loudly on things that no one cares about on this podcast? I think it is.
Can we just cut that out? And that can be the stinger for your segment.
Yeah.